The Sis Silke Schmidt interviewing Bill Sugden for part two of our oral history interview for the UW Archives. Today is November 21st, 2016. So I have just two things I wanted to clarify on record from our previous conversation. You said you formally enrolled at Columbia in 1972 and received your PhD in 1973. So that's pretty short. Did the time you spent at Cold Harbor kind of count toward your...
Yes, the work that I had done as a quasi-technician was allowed to constitute part of my dissertation, so that my year enrollment in Columbia was time for me to teach one course, to prove residency, and to take a series of exams, and then to defend my dissertation. That's what I did.
Wow.
Short.
Yes, short but an eventful year, it sounds like.
Yes, definitely.
And then you also talked a little bit about your job offer in England that you ended up declining. So after you graduated from Columbia, so you're in the States, did you actually spend any time in England before or during your postdoc at the Karolinska, or was it just an offer that came about in some other way and then you didn't end up accepting it?
The way the offer came to pass is that John Cairns, who had been head of Cold Spring Harbor, the director, prior to Jim Watson, moved to the ICRF in Mill Hill and was starting a unit on to carry out cancer research. He hired Joe Sambrook, and Joe, in effect, hired me. It's at that time that I left for Stockholm, and in fact, when I left, I went with Joe and visited his family in England, visited John Cairns in London, and then moved on to Stockholm. I would have gone to Mill Hill, but for the fact that Joe, during the intervening year and a half when I was in Sweden, decided to take, I think, a position in Texas, in Dallas. So he became chair of biochemistry, and he had been a major motivation for my going to England. He's a very charismatic person. I liked working with him. And then his not taking that position made it less attractive for me.
Okay, got it. That makes sense. All right, so let's go back to Howard Taman. So last time we got as far as him receiving the Nobel, which was right around the time you got here. And then you basically went on to be colleagues for almost 20 years,
yes.
Both of you working here. Would you say that two of you had pretty similar or pretty distinct research programs during this time?
Both. I mean, he worked on retroviruses. He initially worked on Rauch sarcoma virus, a chicken retrovirus, and then a lot on spleen necrosis virus, another avian retrovirus. I came here to work on Epstein-Barr virus, which is a human herpes virus. So the viruses are very different. The kinds of interests we had on studying those viruses were shared. I think Howard worked on Rauch sarcoma virus primarily because he developed a transformation assay for it, and it causes tumors incredibly rapidly in chickens. I worked on Epstein-Barr virus because it was likely to cause cancers, and by the time I came here, we really knew it did cause cancer in people. So there were parallel motivations. In some ways, there were parallel experimental approaches. We both did most of our experiments with cells and culture, but the kinds of questions we addressed had to be idiosyncratic for those viruses, okay. And they're very different viruses. So in one way, yes, we were asking very similar questions at one level, but in the lab, no, we would use quite different techniques.
Okay. So I don't know if that also answers the next question. Did you ever publish joint papers, apply for grants together, or jointly mentor trainees, or was it two different?
No. So within a year or two of my coming here, Howard wrote what was called a program project grant, where he was the PI, and I was a co-PI or an independent investigator, but the fact is he was the head of that grant application. And before he died, I took it over and I ran it up until 3 years ago. So it's a way of communally funding people who do research on virology or tumor virology in this department. We probably never co-authored a paper, although I wrote papers about his research, but we never co-authored a paper. I was often on the graduate committees of his students and vice versa. I think we dealt with students in different ways, and so it was complementary. He was a great colleague, really, for me, but for the people in the department. So it wasn't as if he were reclusive or anything like that. He was a participant in the department, and we both benefited from each other. I know I benefited from him.
Okay. So then something that occurred to me as I was thinking about this, did he ever seriously consider leaving this institution I'm sure he got some pretty high profile job offers elsewhere, you know, once you get the Nobel, I assume that's sort of a natural,
I'm sure.
Yeah, but as far as, you know, he didn't leave, so did he consider anything, or was he just really committed to staying here?
He was offered jobs at Harvard, for example. I assume he would be offered jobs elsewhere, and he declined those offers, I think because he both liked the department and Rayla, and he liked this as a place to raise their two children. So I think there were many reasons to stay in Madison. I think also that just the kind of science that he was doing could be done here successfully, and he was happy in that. So he did not need the high-profile environment that Harvard would provide, for example. It's a different way of doing science. So I think he was happy here.
Okay. Would you say his group of trainees became much larger than before the award, because so many more people now knew of him and wanted to work with him? Was there just a much larger pool of applicants, many of whom he had to turn down, or did it not change that much?
I think there were more applicants for sure, but he didn't allow it to change. An example of Howard and the way he dealt with his fame is that he insisted on the day that he won the Nobel Prize to come in the lab and look at his cells and behave as if it were just like the previous day, and he did that. And when I first was here, he had 4 graduate students and 4 postdocs and 4 specialists, and I think that's the number of people he worked with until he died.
Okay.
So he knew that which he wanted to do, and he did it.
Right. Can you talk a little bit about his research program after the award? I'm sure he continued to work with RSV. At some point then HIV/AIDS kind of entered the picture and entered his career in particular, but what are we talking about? 20 years, I guess, post-Nobel. So I know that's hard to describe.
Well, he actually didn't work much with RAS sarcomavirus. I think he knew that it would be studied by multiple people, and he chose to work on a much less well-known virus, but in the same general family, and that's the spleen necrosis virus. And I think, again, he did that because the kinds of questions he wanted to answer, he could answer with that virus and avoid some of the stepping on other people's feet and vice versa. The reason he began working on HIV, and largely that work wasn't so much in the lab as public, trying to fashion a rational scientific approach to working with HIV throughout this country. Because what happened is a huge amount of money was thrown at it, so that today research on HIV dominates all of virology by far. So more is known about HIV than any other virus. And that reflects money being spent on it and then people going to work on it. I think he wanted to contribute not so much by working on that virus, but by ensuring that the money be well spent. So he was very involved in Washington, at NCI, at NIH in general, in just participating as a powerful virologist and ensuring the money was well spent, and I think he made real contributions that way. There were a lot of politics, as you can imagine, among some of the people who claimed to have discovered it or who wanted to have the recognition of working on it, and he was an umpire, if anything, to ensure that it was dealt with fairly. So he made, I think, very important contributions, but less from the research basis and more from policy basis.
Okay. And so research-wise, So I'm sorry, what was, is there an abbreviation for the virus?
SNV.
SNV?
SNV. Spleen necrosis virus.
Okay. What did he...
work on?
Yeah.
Let me describe one
okay.
Area. So retroviruses are called retro because they take information flow in the opposite direction mm-hmm. that it had been thought to go. It mm-hmm. does go in most cells. Mm-hmm. So rather than going from DNA to RNA to protein, it goes from RNA to DNA, and then in fact back to RNA and then to protein is mm-hmm. the way it really happens. He was fascinated with that process, and people in the lab studied it at an enzymatic level and at a biological level to dissect it. Along the way, he realized that you could then make what I'm going to call a vector. And by that I mean a nucleic acid platform that you could then express in a cell to express whatever you wanted. So today, sort of experiments I'll do is I'm going to take a retroviral vector, and which is a piece of nucleic acid, and introduce into it a gene that I'm interested in expressing in a cell. And then I can package that nucleic acid in a protein shell and infect a cell, and it gets integrated into the genome of the recipient cell. That kind of developing a vector is something he spent a lot of time, or people in his lab spent a lot of time doing, in the early 80s. So that they became very powerful tools. And his lab was not alone in doing that, but his lab was one of the pioneers in doing and generating retroviral vectors that were practical. And they've been used in gene therapy. They've been used to introduce genes into animals and into people, and they'll continue to be a really powerful tool. So that's one kind of project that his group worked on for many years. Let's see if I can give you another with spleen necrosis virus. Well, the actual mechanism of, we'll call it reverse transcription. What happens when you have a retrovirus to the RNA that's in that virus particle? Well, it gets copied into DNA. How does that get copied? Mm-hmm. That DNA copy, the provirus, gets integrated into the genome of the recipient cell. How does it get integrated? Each of those steps were something that he worked out in detail. And he was particularly interested in this process of reverse transcription going from an RNA template to a DNA template. Could imagine it would introduce mutations into that DNA template, and he then measured, or people working with him measured, the rate of mutation formation in the process of reverse transcription. And it's much more mutagenic than, for example, when our DNA is passed in the germline. Mm-hmm. So that became something that was really interesting to him, and proved very important to people who trained with him, like John Coffin, who works on HIV, to appreciate the frequency with which mutations arise in HIV just during its replication. So I would say that the understanding the rate of mutation in retroviruses was another really major contribution from Howard.
Okay. What about, didn't he also work on trying to understand the evolutionary aspect of things, and then didn't he make it, I don't know, were oncogenes already known at this time, or was that something that was...
He made real contributions to understanding the evolution of rapidly transforming retroviruses and their relationship to oncogenes. So viruses like Ralph's sarcoma virus, as I said, cause tumors extremely rapidly. Mm-hmm. And they carry information into the cell that is an oncogene. And that oncogene is what's going to drive the change in the virus and the evolution to be a tumor. The oncogene, in fact, is derived from a cellular gene. And that's something that Howard postulated early on. And that he studied both in spleen necrosis virus, and then his studies led to other people like Farmus and Bishop, who subsequently got Nobel Prizes, for identifying the oncogene in Ralph's sarcoma virus. So yes, he studied it. He did study that phenomenon, or that biology actually, in spleen necrosis virus too. And again, what he had posited and what proved to be true, and really I think is shown first by Farmus and Bishop, is that rapidly transforming viruses pick up information from a cell and then deliver that information, which has evolved slightly, to another recipient cell, and that new information is what drives tumors caused by retroviruses. In you and me, if we get mutations in these oncogenes, then their mutant derivatives can really drive tumor formation in us spontaneously without the intervention of a virus.
Okay. All right. Let's see. So you going back to the biography that you wrote about Howard, you mentioned he served on 12 national and international committees between 85 and his death, so that's like not even 10 years. And it, from what I've heard you say before, it sounded like he felt pretty strongly about that part of his career. I mean, that was his form of service, really, and
yes,
to the...
Exactly, to the world.
Yes, right, right. So he took that pretty seriously, and it didn't... I'm sure sometimes he wished he had fewer committees to serve on because it took time away from the research, but I mean, by and large...
Well, and from his family, both.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But, I mean, as he said, it was something that he could do once he had received the recognition that he got, and he was going to spend that recognition as constructively as he could, and he did. I mean, an example which is both humorous and hard to imagine is that in the late 70s, probably, yeah, the late 70s, we would always eat lunch at Union South. Mm-hmm. So it would be Howard and Roland and Paul Kaysberg, and I would eat just before this student seminar. And there was no smoking allowed at some point. Up until that time, people could smoke. After that, there were signs all over. And I can remember him getting up shortly after the signs were put up, going over to somebody who was smoking and saying, "You've got to stop or leave the room." And, I mean, they didn't know who he was, but you know, he wasn't going to allow that to happen. And that's typical. Mm-hmm. I mean, when he was convinced that something was right, he would act on it.
Right.
In a very forthright way.
And didn't he do this smoking thing in particular also in Sweden, like at the reception?
Yes, he did. And that was quite famous because I don't remember whether it was the king or his spouse was smoking, and he said something about how inappropriate that was. And of course he was right, but it wasn't perhaps politically correct, but he did it anyway.
All right. Oh, yeah. Okay, so that wasn't actually on my list here to ask specifically about being the anti-smoking advocate. So that was a specific, that's the one that comes to mind the most, just here,
well, and
being in Union South. And
yeah, and actually going to, I know he went up to the, what am I trying to say, at the end of the street, the government, and was asked to, what was it? I think he spoke before some insurance commission pointing out how the price of life insurance for those who do not smoke should be decreased relative to those who do smoke because of the obvious cost of smoking. So he did things like that too.
That was at the state capitol?
State capitol.
Yeah, okay.
And
okay.
That would have been also probably late 70s, early 80s. So
okay.
When before it was so easily or well thought of as it is now. So he was certainly an advocate to stop people from smoking.
Right, right. I guess that another thing that was mentioned, and you know, some of the online stuff that exists about him, Wikipedia mentioned his work helping Jewish scientists in the Soviet Union. Now, this was 1976, so you were already here. Do you know anything about this, where he just kind of... help publicize how, you know, they had a much harder time doing their science.
Well, he actually traveled to the Soviet Union,
mm-hmm,
then and met with a number of the people who were refuseniks, and both brought them information from this country and then tried to bring information behind the scenes back to this country and back to Europe, where in any way that he could to help the people who were in general, yes, Jewish, but not only Jewish, who were being incredibly limited by the Soviet Union. So he was an advocate for them, too. There, it was, he probably could do less than he could do in this country because of his position here, as opposed to his lack of a position within the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
But he definitely took I mean, he's talked about it, somewhat difficult positions of contacting people when it was illegal to contact them in Moscow, and it's I don't know if it was only in Moscow, to try to both bring them some idea of what was available outside of the Soviet Union and to get from them information about what it was like to be there,
mm-hmm,
I mean, a more explicit example of that I do know about is that there had been a person here who was a postdoc with Howard who returned to then Czechoslovakia and had been, as long as Czechoslovakia was under the thumb of the Soviet Union, was not allowed even to work with graduate students. So he was allowed to be in a lab, but only by himself. And all of his resources were removed, so he could do no science. And Howard ensured that all of the things he needed to do science came from here and were sent to him in a collaborative way that was perfectly legal from the U.S. standard, but it's the only way he could do science. Hmm. And he became, I think, so Czech, it must have been not Slovakia, it was Czech. The mm-hmm. Czech government then eventually led him to be the head of the equivalent of NIH.
Oh.
So he was a substantial contributor to science in the Czech Republic, and prior to that time had been sustained through Howard's helping him.
Okay.
So
you're saying his trainee who went back there became
right.
the head of their version
eventually.
Of it, eventually.
But,
okay.
But for a long time, heck, wasn't even allowed to do science.
Right.
I mean, as long as the Soviet Union was in power there, or their, I guess you'd say, puppets were in power in Czechoslovakia.
Mm-hmm.
But he, with the help of Howard, continued to do science and continued to make contributions such that it was recognized for his scientific ability after the
mm-hmm.
fall of the, of the Soviet Union, actually,
mm-hmm.
and then became head of, I think, the equivalent of NIH.
Okay.
So,
wow.
A very impressive person.
Yeah,
so that's
definitely.
And, you know, that was a very personal contribution
right,
for Howard.
Right, yes.
It wasn't anything done through the government or anything else. It was what he could do through here.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So then he died at the age of 59 due to a form of lung cancer that's unrelated to smoking. And was that, like, really rapidly progressing? Like, when did he have to stop working or at least come into the lab because of this disease?
He found out in about September of 92 and died in January or February of 94.
Okay, so a little over a year.
Mm-hmm.
And was he pretty sick during that time?
He was quite sick. Not so much directly from the tumor as from all of the therapy. And he recognized that the life expectancy or the chances of actually getting over this were very small, and therefore was willing, not because it was pleasant for him, but because it could help people in the future. And I mean this, that he would take on some of these experimental therapies, which were quite difficult and
mm-hmm.
physically demanding. So, among the things I tried to do was to read books so I could find him a book that he would read when he was in the acute stages of the chemotherapy. It's very difficult. So I read a lot and he read a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And he continued, I mean, I know this through my wife. The chemotherapy can be really demanding for several days, and for those several days he would not be able to come in, but maybe after 3 or 4 days he would come back to the lab and continue again as if nothing had happened.
Mm.
He would teach. So the last semester, so this would have been the fall of 93,
mm-hmm.
I taught the course for him most of the time. But then he wanted to come in and give a talk, and I can't remember which day it was, but it was in December, was his last lecture.
Wow.
So he was quite dedicated.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's not only being dedicated, it's having a raison d'être, having a way to lead your life such that you're not overwhelmed by all the difficulties he was facing. He wouldn't be overwhelmed by them. So he was also quite a strong person.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And what was it particularly challenging for some of the trainees that he had at the time? I mean, did you guys, the rest of you, sort of, you know, try to come in more into the projects that he had been directing so that things could continue?
It's not so much that someone like me did any of the research, but I did take over whenever it was needed, guiding the students and the postdocs that were in his lab. And then after his death, several of them moved into this lab so that I could guide them until they moved on, be they students or postdocs. Mm-hmm. So a number of people who really were trained by Howard actually in the end spent time with me.
I see.
They were mainly in this lab.
Okay.
They were all in this lab.
Okay.
And then I, you know, things like I had to, for those people who are postdocs and were in the midst of looking for jobs, then I had to substitute. And of course, I couldn't substitute. I could just do my best. But they did all well.
Mm-hmm.
They did find the jobs they wanted, I think, in the end.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But that would not. So I think that, you know, it's a transition that was difficult, but largely thanks to people in the department, worked out as well as it humanly could have. So that was good.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And would you say, were there people in the lab that, continued some of the work he had started? It sounds like quite a few of them transitioned to working with you.
Yeah,
but
still finished their projects. They
okay.
work on when I was working on, they finished doing this. They finished the projects with SNV or whatever else they were working on.
Mm-hmm.
It's just I helped them.
Okay.
And then people who've trained with him have gone on to work in retroviruses very successfully throughout the world.
Right, that was kind of my next question. I think, are there former trainees that really, are there some that stayed or have returned to McArdle? And then if not, are there, you know, where are they now? Are some of them particularly noteworthy for their research career and contributions?
Oh, yes, definitely. So in this country, perhaps the most senior person who's well known, who trained with Howard as a graduate student, is a man by the name of John Coffin. And John has been instrumental, I mentioned him already, in appreciating really the evolution of HIV during its infection and what that means. So here's an example, and this reflects John's insights in his work. If you just could measure the number of mutations that accumulate in the HIV genome from the time a person is infected until the time normally the disease becomes apparent, that's AIDS, you'd know that every single nucleotide in that virus has been mutated. The significance of that is then when you treat a person first with a drug that is directed against, say, the polymerase enzyme, the reverse transcriptase, there are already pre-existing mutants in that person's body that are going to be resistant to that drug.
Mm.
Well, that then says, you know the resistance is going to accumulate, and so you then need a second kind of therapy, and it's that kind of insight that came from John's work, and John's work came out of Howard's work appreciating the lack of fidelity in making RNA out of DNA for the reverse transcription that gives rise to this high rate of mutation.
Mm-hmm.
So John is outstanding and has run, he's at Tufts, he runs his own research program at Tufts, but he ran a research program simultaneously at NIH in Frederick. That now, a large number of people at Frederick actually also were trained by Howard. One of the heads there is a man by the name of Eric Fried, who worked first with Rex Risser as an undergrad and then as a postdoc with Howard. Rex used to be here too, Rex's dad. There's Mike Emmerman at University of Washington in Seattle he's editor of virology and works on HIV and was trained with Howard as a graduate student. Wei Xiao, who's at NIH, was trained. There are some of the leaders in retrovirology in America were trained by Howard.
Okay.
So it's a very impressive next generation. They reflect the rigor and the drive that he had as
mm-hmm.
a scientist.
Mm-hmm. Well, John, what was his last name?
Coffin, Coffin.
Okay.
Tufts,
and
he is certainly, I think, now the most senior of the people
mm-hmm.
Educated by Howard
mm-hmm.
in this country.
Mm-hmm. And of the current faculty, is there still anybody that wants to work directly with him?
No one here
okay.
now has other. One of the faculty, Nito Pankadaban, trained with him, but now was here as a faculty member, but moved eventually to work. I think he's in New Mexico.
Okay. All right, so that so it sounds like even though he personally didn't work on HIV, he kind of trained these people
many
who
people.
Now make very
definitely.
Significant.
Definitely.
Okay,
definitely.
Gotcha. Let's see. So, and then in terms of his family, you said that his wife Rayla continued her career here as a UW
yes.
professor
in
and
genetics.
When, okay, and what, did she retire?
She's retired. I'd say maybe four or five years ago.
Four or five years ago, okay. I noticed she had she was on WPR at some point talking about James Crowe, the geneticist.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so James Crowe was her postdoctoral advisor.
Oh, okay.
And
okay.
then they were in the Department of Genetics together for many,
many years.
Many years.
Okay.
And he is also was a very charismatic person and a very fine scientist, too.
Okay, okay. Yeah. Do you think Howard's fame had an continued to have an impact on Rayla's life after his death, or not so much? I mean, was she somehow better known because of him, or?
Oh, probably. I mean, I think so. I mean, part of the. I mean, she when once he became sick, she contracted her own research and work in the university and just devoted herself to taking care of him.
Uh-huh.
So there was a hiatus in her work while
right,
he was ill.
Right.
And while he was ill, people would come, I mean us, from all over the world to visit and say hi, and many of them ended up staying with us, and then they would
mm-hmm.
stay with us and spend a little bit of time with him because
okay.
he had very limited energy. So her life was changed
mm-hmm.
dramatically by
mm-hmm.
his illness. Certainly, she, I think both she and he tried to protect the kids from this outside somewhat superficial interest.
Mm-hmm.
By the time he died, the kids had both gone to university and pretty much left home. And then Rayla, in a very impressive way, reintegrated herself back into the university.
Mm-hmm.
And to how much was that affected by his fame? I don't really know. Some
mm-hmm.
of it had to be, but
right,
I can't
right.
quantify
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm. And then what about his children? It looks like I try to find a little bit of information. Did they both? It sounds like one of them works on HIV professionally, and the other sort of more women's health, or?
Well, one of them, so one's in New York, one's in Washington. They both work, say, in public health in one way. Miriam in New York has been worked for a long time in public health with respect to women's health, you could say, but both in Africa with respect to more than HIV, but just the inequality of health care throughout the continent of Africa, throughout the world for that matter, but focusing
mm-hmm.
on women.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, Sarah is part of ASCO and works on helping, which is the American
Society for Clinical Oncology,
yeah,
like
clinical oncology.
So right, so cancer, right?
Yeah, cancer, and both in helping them write policy papers and in making decisions that affect what positions they take.
Mm-hmm.
So they're both definitely both have degrees in public health.
So clearly inspired by
oh yeah, I think
Howard
so.
And
perhaps
them
so. And by their mother too.
Yes,
definitely,
yes, right,
definitely.
Yeah.
So they're a very impressive family.
Right, that's what it sounds like. Yeah. Yeah, so that was okay. That kind of wraps up the part about Howard, but I did want to come back and talk a little bit about your work, especially since he passed away, but even before. So we talked a little bit. Epstein-Barr has been you've dedicated your career to Epstein-Barr,
yeah.
It sounds like, ever since. So initially your dissertation was SV40, and then you switched to Epstein-Barr when you went to Karolinska, and have stuck with it ever since. So
yes,
what has fascinated you all this time about this particular virus?
Well, it actually is going to go back to before I knew anything about the virus. I can't tell you rationally, but I can tell you emotionally, I've always wanted to do cancer research. And when I was at Columbia, I was doing chemistry, so I could do work on chemical carcinogenesis. And then through this very circuitous path, I ended up working in virology, working at Cold Spring Harbor. And working on SV40 was satisfying, but it's a model virus.
Mm-hmm.
It certainly doesn't cause tumors in you and me. And I wanted to work on some aspect of cancer that affects people. Having learned something about viruses, I figured I better learn something about human tumor viruses. none was known in 1972 when I applied as a postdoc, but for the next year. But it sounded as if Epstein-Barr virus was likely to cause cancer in us, so I went to Stockholm to learn about it. And I've stayed with it because, well, for many reasons. One, if I possibly could, and I, the first person singular is inappropriate. I mean, it's always going to be we, but you know, you're asking me, so I'm going to use the first person singular. If I could make any contributions to helping the kids in Central Africa who die of Burkitt's lymphoma, it would be marvelous. So it's the tumor that I first realized was likely to be caused by EBV, and it's the first tumor for which there was compelling data that said it was caused by this virus. The tumor arises in children who are 4 to 7 years of age, roughly, and they're going to die of it. It's found in rural parts of Africa. It can be treated reasonably successfully if it occurs in us, because it's so fast growing, it's really quite sensitive to either to radiation therapy or to some chemotherapy. But none of those approaches are going to work in poor countries in Central Africa, period. They don't have the money. Mm-hmm. So one of my, until somewhat recently, fantasies have been, could we develop drugs that would be effective? And actually, from the work we've done, we know we could in the abstract. Whether we can is a different issue. I mean, that may sound like nitpicking, but it's not. We were able to identify a protein encoded by the virus whose function, when blocked, leads to the loss of the viral information from the tumor cell, and we've shown that when that happens, the tumor cell dies. So drugs that would do the same thing that we can do in the lab, if they were to be cheap and effective, would really be probably a good cure. Mm-hmm. Now, would that cure all the kids? No, of course not, because some of them will develop variants of the tumor that would be resistant, etc. But it certainly should be beneficial. And that's something we're trying to do. So one of the things that has kept me working on EBV is not so much rational as an emotional goal. I'd like to make the world better, and that's something I know about, so maybe I can make it better that way. And again, it's never just I. I mean, and I'm not being modest, it's true, it's us, but anyway. It's also a fascinating virus to study for a lot of reasons, and I can describe some of them, but think of it in another way. I'm an expert on this virus. Most of what I do is not research. It's to teach graduate students how to become experts in a tiny area of biology so they too can go on and do research. So I have to work on some in some focused area in order to teach. And since I learned about EBV early on and began working on it, I continue to work on it. I wouldn't do that if I were working solely with postdoctoral fellows in a research institute, but I'm in a university. And I think my responsibility really here is to be a teacher too, and that means primarily to graduate students. So that's why I've also been conservative in continuing to work with the same thing that I've worked with.
Okay. Have you visited Central Africa? And no.
Never. I've never been on that continent, but one of the things that I did learn when I was in Sweden is much about the places of Africa where it occurs. And that's in part because the Swedish government maintained a hospital in Nairobi. It's through that hospital that we got biopsies from the children who had Burkitt's once a week. So my failure to go to Africa, I think, really hasn't affected my research or me. I learned a lot about that tumor when I was in Stockholm. So
okay.
And children get it here. I have met children here who have it.
Okay.
It's just the frequency is about 1/10 that which it is in Central Africa.
So it sounds like my next question was going to be, how much have we learned about it since 1973, which is like 40 some years? And who are some of the other people in addition to yourself who have driven that Epstein-Barr virus research forward? Do you want to just mention some other names,
sure,
like either here or collaborators elsewhere?
George Klein in Stockholm, the person with whom I was a postdoc, certainly is a major figure. Others, Elliot Keefe, who's at Harvard, is a major figure. I'm speaking of the elderly folks now, too, by the way. There are many younger people,
right,
too, but George Miller at Yale is a driving force behind this research too. And we probably constitute some of the older people working on it. But for each of us, there are probably 10 labs run by younger people that also work. There are multiple labs in this department. So Shannon Kenny works on it, Janet Mertz works on it, and Eric, who's right down the hall, works on it. So there's at least three more labs that work on this.
Okay. So it sounds like you, when you get to the point where you are thinking about retirement, you can be assured that there are
other groups
many
will
people
continue
who will
to work on
yes.
it for sure. I think that a number of people will continue to work on it so long as the federal government's willing to support cancer research. And I think that if there comes a time when there are either vaccines or there are drugs of the sort that I hope we might be able to at least begin to identify, then it will become less popular.
Mm.
And you can see that in things like polio. I mean, the polio virus was studied by virologists as a central virus of interest in the late 50s through the 60s. But as the vaccine became more and more effective, interest in it declined. And I think one of the things that's maintained interest in HIV is the fact that although there are good drugs out there, throughout the world, it's a massive problem. I think there are 40 million people who are alive and infected with it worldwide now. So as long as those numbers are that way, people can continue to work on it too.
Mm-hmm. So your work has been more aimed at finding drugs to treat it. Is there some possibility that someday there might be a vaccine?
I hope so. I think I could make a vaccine that would work, by the way. The problem is that even if I could make a vaccine that would work in the abstract, testing it will be hell.
Mm.
Because the places you have to have a way to know that it works. Well, since people are going to get infected throughout, say, in this country, up and through puberty, you have to test them before they're infected. That kind of thing becomes very expensive. And you have to have people to buy into that test. So while I think I could make a vaccine that would work, I'm really sure that I couldn't test it in an appropriate population.
Mm.
That takes a kind of political skill and money that it goes beyond what a university can do. So I can say how to make the vaccine. It's simple. It turns out you can't vaccinate against herpes viruses with dead vaccines. With viruses that are not competent to replicate, it doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the vaccines that does work is for chickenpox, the Varicella Zoster virus.
Mm-hmm.
That's a live attenuated virus, and you know it's safe. So you want to make a vaccine for Epstein-Barr virus, take that attenuated vaccine and introduce into it bits and pieces of EBV that could not affect the host, but will provide the information to serve
mm-hmm.
as, to be recognized
mm-hmm.
as a vaccine. So I'm sure you can do that,
mm-hmm.
and I'm sure it would work. I just don't know how to get it tested.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I'd be beating the bushes to try and do that.
So is the HPV, is that a similar story? I mean,
it's a killed vaccine. So the way that vaccine works is it's actually not even derived from a virus. So the salt vaccine was polio that was inactivated.
Mm-hmm.
And it was inactivated with a chemical, formaldehyde. The HPV vaccine is made in yeast, probably, and it's one of the proteins or two of the proteins, depending on how it's made. And they'll assemble in what looks like a virus particle in the EM, in the electron microscope. But there's no nucleic acid, it's not infectious.
Mm-hmm.
So then that protein is given to you, and you make antibodies to that protein. And that's what serves as the vaccine. So you're now prepared when you encounter that virus to already immunologically to recognize it and inactivate it.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of vaccine has never worked for herpes virus. The only, which says something about how our immune system recognizes herpes viruses. It's different from HPV. It's different from hepatitis B virus, which is also just a protein. It's not, it has no nucleic acid and it's not competent to replicate itself. But all of the vaccines so far that have worked in animals or in people for herpes viruses are attenuated live vaccines.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody's going to allow you to put an attenuated tumor virus in you. it makes sense. You shouldn't be allowed to. I
think. Yeah.
But making this hybrid, I think, would work.
Okay. Okay. Interesting. Let's see. We have, what, five more minutes?
Yep.
Okay, let me just... why do you think it is that viruses play such an important role in human diseases? Is there any, like, evolutionary reason, or...?
Well, look, they play an important role, but until we learned how to deal with bacteria, and bacteria probably killed more people, what is it? I think at least I've read, I don't know if it's true, I don't know how you could know if it's true, that the most important public health contribution in the history of humanity is cheap cotton underwear. So you can wash it. So you can have two pieces. I think bacteria probably killed many more people historically, but we know how to avoid them. Sometimes viruses would kill huge numbers. So the Red Plague was smallpox. That killed a third of Europe in medieval times more than once. But so did the Black Plague, and that's a bacterium. Viruses are important because they evolve, and they can only replicate inside a living organism, and when they evolve to replicate in us, they can give us a pain.
Mm-hmm.
So, and they'll always be around. As long as we're around, there'll be viruses around. So,
and is there a silver lining at all for viruses? Is there anything good about them?
Well, sure. You can use them as a tool. So I think there are a large number of instances now when you can engineer plants such that if that plant is fed upon by some plant pathogen, that plant pathogen is killed by the virus the plant carries, for example. And that allows us to have more cheap food.
Okay.
So yes, they can be used as tools, definitely.
Okay. Okay.
Definitely.
Gotcha. Let's see. In terms of HPV, have some of your colleagues here been involved in that?
Yes. Paul Lambert, definitely.
Okay.
And Paul has been a major contributor to the studies of HPV and actually indirectly to the development of a vaccine. So he's been a major contributor.
Okay. I mean, is that the most recent cancer vaccine that we have? And that has been, I mean, that is
yes,
given
really
specifically
is, really.
To prevent
and
cancer, right?
Sure. And, that's a, in terms of numbers of effective people, that's enormous. That's a major vaccine success.
Okay.
Definitely.
And when did that?
In the last 20 years, but the vaccine was probably developed and started to be used only about 15 years ago.
Okay, so pretty recent.
Yes.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Okay. All right. Well, shall we? It's just 2 minutes.
I think I should go because it's a student committee.
Okay. Sounds good. Well.